We are talking about the Dyatlov Pass incident in Russia, an amazing story. The author of the latest book on this, Dead Mountain, by the way, it's up there on Amazon.com now, Donnie Eicher with us, and we'll be back with more and your questions on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Donnie Eicher with us. Donnie, what about this photograph that was taken toward the end of this horrible episode? Can you explain that for us or tell us about it?
I can. I think it was taken on accident when the investigators reached in and grabbed the camera, or when they were going to pull the film out of the camera, they accidentally fired off a shot.
What does it show?
Well, it's kind of a light trail, but... You know, and I studied this photo for quite a few months and came to this conclusion, because the thing is, if they were trying to take a photo of something
that was attacking them, let's say,
that was attacking them, I don't think you would be trying to take a photo at that moment.
No, you wouldn't have your smartphone up there going, hold on here, you'd be gone.
Exactly. Or if it were something in the sky, I don't think they would be trying to take a photo of something like that.
Just an unbelievable story. So I'm now thinking, my theory is, when you just mentioned NOAA, that maybe there was some kind of weather anomaly, and you tying in that hauling sound that the people said they heard and they were scared of it, that maybe they heard something that just scared the living daylights out of them. But God, that would have to be horrible to run out like that.
And it's complete darkness.
And you have no clothes on.
Yeah, improperly dressed. And it was a 33% moon that morning, but the moon didn't even come up till 4 a.m. So we're talking complete darkness.
I mean, even if I heard the worst scream of my life, I'm not sure I'd run out. Would you?
It depends on how long the scream or the noise lasted.
You mean maybe it was so much they went crazy listening to it?
Perhaps.
God, you're going to be a tough sell. Are you going to end up turning this into a documentary?
You know, I had originally set out to do that, and I came back with all this data, and I realized, you know, I really want to tell the hiker's story, as I said as well. It was really important to me, and it's such a complicated story. I thought the best way to separate fact from fiction and really tell this story is in a book.
Has anybody been back there to camp since this episode in 1959?
There's been people there in the summer, but I later found out, actually, I was the first person outside of Russia to go there in the winter. And
nobody does that anymore.
There's just really no reason to go there, and it's just extremely remote. And, you know, this isn't Everest. I never would want to put that out there that, you know, we went and scaled Everest or something like that. It's just, the fact is, it's extremely remote and there is nothing there. So there's no real reason to go there. And, you know, I definitely felt that remoteness when I was standing there where they had placed the tent, looking down into the ravine where the bodies were found. It was quite a surreal moment for me, because 4 years before that, I had never heard the name Dyatlov. And
no.
I couldn't imagine in my wildest dreams I would be standing the gateway of Siberia in the northern Ural Mountains, looking down into where 9 Russian hikers had died that I had no real connection to.
One of the theories, they went ballistic over a woman. I can't see that happening.
No. You know, they... as was shown in all their journal entries and interviewing the friends and family of the hikers, these were gentlemen adventurers. And that was something also that I really admired, There was a certain, even though it was in the Cold War, there was a certain innocence that existed to get off the beaten track. And there was a real level of respect there, I was told. Even if there was a love interest, they would never show it on an expedition.
Right.
Because
right.
In an expedition, the goal is to overcome the distance. And that's that. You would never bring a love interest or a problem into the expedition.
Now, though your theory is speculative, how much credence would you give it in terms of possibilities?
I think it's a pretty solid theory, just considering the various experts and scientists that I worked with that, were all at the top of their fields. And, I spent 4 years of my life separating the fact from fiction and weighing out each theory. And I think it's a very solid conclusion.
How close am I when I talked about the howling winds?
Well, I'll tell you over a beer.
Well, you are in L.A., aren't you?
Yes.
I'll catch you. Let's take a few calls here. Let's go to Glenn in Harlingen, Texas. Hey, Glenn, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good morning, George.
Hey.
I'd like to ask your guest exactly where they were in the Urals. That's the extreme northern Urals. And what kind of tent was it? Was this a big canvas military-style tent from the 1950s where each person is packing a piece of canvas, and it stretches out to be a 30-foot room with a high roof, a cabin-style big canvas tent?
What kind of tent was it, Donnie?
Indeed, it was. It was a military tent, and it was actually two tents that had been sewn together. And it was quite long, and, it had button fasteners on the front of it. Was quite heavy duty.
What do you say it was, 20 by 20? Pretty good guess?
No, it was more, of a long shape, but it definitely had a fairly high roof. It was, I think it was 30 feet long. It's quite a large tent.
That's a good size. And whereabouts in the Urals? Can you pinpoint
Yeah,
it?
They were in the northern Urals.
Okay. Has the Russian government ever said much about it? Since?
Well, the case was sort of buried till Perestroika in the late 80s.
Pulled it out. Huh?
And then it came out along with a lot of other stuff. And, there's a lot of people that think there's still a lot of stuff buried in there. But one question I would have for that is, what would they be hiding, considering a lot of the Stalin classified files came out and revealed just atrocities?
Yeah.
What would they possibly be hiding that happened to 9 hikers?
Well, even if they witnessed, for example, a missile test, big deal.
Yeah.
You don't have to kill them over that. There's something else to it, something strange. Let's go to Victor in Sacramento, California. Hi, Victor. Go ahead.
Hi. Being at law enforcement, I have so many questions.
Okay.
Number one, her tongue was missing. Was it surgically removed?
It was not.
It was not. Okay. The second thing, that were all the bodies together in one spot, facing the same way, different ways? Did they look like they had been disturbed or mutilated in any way?
Their bodies were found roughly a mile from the campsite. They were in separate locations, half-dressed. Some were found face down in the snow. Others were in a fetal position. Some were found in a ravine clutching each other. So they were in different locations.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Was her tongue ever recovered?
It was not.
Why that question, Victor? You're on to something. Tell me.
Well, I'm on to animals, and why was she just mutilated? why only Earth? And there's more to the 1 mile apart, and they stayed together the whole entire time.
If they seem to have all died together.
They did. And the elements would obviously affect everybody the same way. However, you say they're experienced, but they're shown no experience at all when they took off like that.
Well, they actually were found in separate locations. Two were found, they had started a fire at a large cedar tree. And when they found the bodies, they were actually, their limbs were burned. So there was others that were found in a ravine. Some were by themselves. So, you know, at the end of the book, I put together a whole recreation from the whole book and all the data and interviewing everyone. It sets up how I think the whole event went down.
Interesting. Yes. Who found that?
Russian searchers did, didn't they?
Yes. The search team found them. Quite a large search team.
Do you think they all died within the same time frame, or did one die 2 hours before the others?
They all died the night of the second, or the morning of the second, late on the first into the morning of February 2nd.
Okay, all probably around the same time period.
Within hours, yes.
You would think if they were a mile away from the tent, that maybe even 300 or 400 feet away, they'd realize, we got to go back. I mean, surely they knew, Donnie, that they could not survive these elements with no clothes, no shoes.
They absolutely did, in my opinion.
They thought they could survive it?
No.
They knew they could.
There was something that scared them enough, and I'm choosing my words
so
correctly
much,
here because
so
I don't want to give anything away, but something intense enough to make them do what they did.
And not go back.
Well, once you're a mile away from the tent in complete darkness, you cannot see your hand in front of your face. You couldn't go back if you wanted to.
No. What would make them, though, go... Look, on foot with no shoes, socks, it's 0 degrees colder. A mile's a darn long way. What would make them go so fast and so far? Why didn't they simply say, wait a minute, we got to get back there eventually. We're not going to go this far. They were running from something, weren't they?
Yes.
So whatever it was, they thought it was chasing. That's why they kept going. How am I doing?
You're doing good.
Let's go to Mike in Los Angeles, first-time caller. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, when I was listening to this this story, the whole time I was wondering, did they have any way to defend themselves, any weapons, guns, or even, like, axes or knives or anything?
Good question.
They didn't have any guns. They did have different axes and things like that. You know, and I did hear stories of the guys in the group. They were all fighters. You know, there was one guy that chased off a bear with a pickaxe. There was all kinds of crazy stories.
But no weapons found near their bodies.
No guns whatsoever.
Wow. Part of the theory, of course, was those Soviet troops or unstrange armed men that came by. Again, we can negate that. You said there were no footprints.
There were no footprints. And, you know, people have said, what if it were convicts that has escaped, you know, from a penitentiary? The problem with that is the nearest penitentiary was over 50 miles away.
Yeah, I'm not sure they would have survived getting out that far.
Plus, why would they attack 9 innocent hikers, even if they on foot went 50 miles? In sub-zero temperatures, what would they have to gain attacking 9 hikers?
Right, exactly. So is it safe to assume that while they were in the tent, those who cut the tent to get out probably felt they could not go through the opening of the tent, the front?
I think they wanted to get out quicker than the people near the entrance of the tent.
I mean, but it's only like 20, 30 feet away. That's not that far.
Well, you can imagine if you think your life is threatened and you're having to wait over a minute for maybe five people, six people in front of you to get out, and you have a knife, you're probably going to cut the back of the tent.
So they probably thought, another one of my conclusions. It was in the tent. So if they're cutting their way out, they probably thought something horrible was in the tent. What do you think of that one?
Well, why they were in darkness.
Why cut the tent to run outside if you think it's outside? That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. It is crazy, and it doesn't make logical sense.
They thought it was inside the tent. Something was inside that tent that scared them so much. They had to cut the tent to jump out. They had to get out fast.
Yes.
And here's the other bizarre part. The knives that they must have used to cut the tent, they left behind.
Yes.
I would have taken it with me.
Yeah, and we have to remember this was a perfectly sufficient tent that was warm with all their food, their sleeping bags, all their clothes, you know. They knew they were stepping into certain death.
Donnie, might there have been some unknown creature that we're just not aware of that was in the tent that made its way in, burrowed its way through?
I don't think so. I think if there was something like that, there would be some type of sign. There would have to be tracks. There would have to be markings on the tent or the hikers. And again, we're talking, you know, seven men. I don't think would all run a mile and leave two women either. And you know,
was the tent disrupted on the inside?
The tent was in perfect condition.
In
the inside.
And their insides were fine. Everything.
Yeah,
their
boots were lined up in all the proper places. There was even slices of ham that was laid out. There was a cup of hot cocoa. Everything was completely undisturbed inside the tent.
Now, how would the woman have lost her tongue?
Well, her name was Luda, and she was known to be the outspoken one of the group. So some would say perhaps she spoke too much. If there was military men that came out there, and this was a sign or symbolism that don't talk about this, but there's a very logical reason why, and that has to do with where she was found in the ravine.
Could she have fallen and bit it off?
No.
So somebody had to cut that tongue out.
I don't think so.
Where did it go? We got to talk about it when we come back. More of the mystery. We'll be back. Well, back by popular demand on our next Coast to Coast program, Michael Rivero joins us as we talk about what the heck happened to the Federal Reserve. He'll talk about TWA Flight 800 and some other riveting topics here on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come back with Donnie Eicher, we're going to talk more about his work, Dead Mountain, and take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Donnie Eicher with us. Donnie, I want to read an email I got from one of our listeners, his theory. This is Rob from New Jersey. Tell me what you think.
Mm-hmm.
People were approached by others who meant them harm, probably kidnap them, sell them to human traffickers for sex or whatever. The kidnappers knew that there were plans because maybe the locals talked about it. They came into the tent and took control. There was an uprising that was violently put down. The girl kept talking. They cut out her tongue. They were being guarded from the outside, and their clothes were taken to prevent escape. When the horror of violent uprising and the removal of the tongue was thought about, running for help and risking frostbite was the least of their troubles. What do you think of that one?
Well, I guess the first thing that comes to mind is, why would people that were going to kidnap somebody go to such an extreme, to such a remote area
to do that?
To do that. And if they did, how would they get them out of such a remote area? As well as, you would see footprints, you would see evidence of other people being there. Sure. And there was no other footprint.
And I think if they were being kidnapped and they ran away, I think they would have been shot.
Yes.
I don't think they'd let them escape thinking, oh, they're going to make it and they'll talk about us or whatever.
I mean, they would have no way of knowing that these hikers were out there. I mean, it's remote, man. It's really far out
there. The people who have heard your conclusion, what do they think of it?
You know, it's been tested by the scientists that I worked with, and they feel pretty confident. It's a really solid conclusion. And, you know, I did work with Russian scientists as well.
Has this ever happened before, this anomaly?
It has.
It has. Elsewhere?
Yeah. It's rare.
But it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
We've ruled out being hallucinogenic here, right?
We have.
We haven't ruled out weather. Let's go to the phones again. Shirley is in Birch Bay, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Shirley. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Donnie Eicher, I am so excited to read this book. About 10 minutes ago, I already put it onto my Nook.
Thank you.
And I do have a question, but I wanted to make a statement. This reminds me of another true story that I read that happened in Russia called The Road to Pechevka. And this one has all the intrigue that one did, and it also is a true story. But you keep saying that there were no tracks. Had it snowed, perhaps, or wind had blown snow after they left that would have covered any tracks, or was the weather, there had not been any snow or anything?
Well, you know, it was almost 3 weeks later when they realized that the hikers went missing. And it actually had snowed, but when the wind blows, it blows the snow back out of the footprints. So the footprints remain.
Oh, okay. Well, I was waiting on the phone. I already started reading it on my reader, but I'm just, George, thank you for bringing this story on, because I don't think I'll probably go to, I was just getting ready to go to bed. And all of a sudden I'm wide awake and I'm just going to go crawl out in the front room in my chair and start reading this book.
Thanks to one of our Coast Insiders who sent us a little message saying, you got to do a story on this. It's been out there. It hasn't, did it get much media coverage back in the 1959, 60?
It didn't. You know, they had the funeral, and it was pretty much shut down and put away. And there's reasons why, I believe. And one big reason is they didn't have an understanding of what happened. So what do you do? 9 young, vibrant hikers die. You have their bodies, but you can't explain it.
The pictures I've seen of the group prior to this episode, obviously, they seem pretty happy.
They were very happy. You know, they were out there just like any group of young hikers. They were having a great time. Contrary to what people may think, they actually didn't touch a drop of liquor. The only alcohol that they had was for medicinal. And, you know, they were really genuinely pure human beings and just, from what I understand from interviewing all their friends and family, just great people. Just there was this great innocence that existed. And like I said, that really fascinated me. I guess, you know, I envy that. I wish that still existed. I wish we could still get off the beaten path and get off the grid and, you know, have those adventures and escapism. But it's pretty tough now.
We did not talk about ghosts. Did you rule that out?
You know, I really didn't.
You didn't go there.
I didn't go there. I had so many other theories that I was trying to work with. I just didn't go there. And it's nothing that I could actually explain if I did believe that were something, considering it was 50 plus years ago.
Well, you know, considering the fact that you said science was involved, then it must be some kind of a weather anomaly of some kind. But why would it scare them so much? That's what's so bizarre. And, I mean, it's not like the tent was shaken from its foundation. It was pretty intact, wasn't it, other than the knife slices?
The tent was intact. Yes, it absolutely was, as well as all the belongings inside their tent. And that was one of the extraordinary findings, you know, because I interviewed the first person. There was two men that discovered the tent. And, you know, the first thing they did, they started screaming out their names. And then they went inside the tent and they were shocked because everything was in place.
Weird.
It was weird. And they actually celebrated for a moment because they thought their friends were coming back.
Well, Donnie Eicher's book, Dead Mountain, The Untold True Story of the Dyatlov Pass Incident. Let's go now to Andrew in Kentucky, east of the Rockies. Andrew, go ahead. Good morning.
Hey, great show tonight, guys.
Thank you, sir.
I just want to ask really quick, you said that it was partially covered in snow. Why couldn't it have been an avalanche that maybe covered the front of the door and they had to, you know, cut the back out and get out that way? Thank you.
Okay. I don't think there was any snow in front of the door, was there?
There was a little bit of snow in front of the door, but
not enough to keep you from leaving.
If it were an avalanche, it would carry the tent down the slope, as well as if the avalanche were to stop at the entrance, the hikers aren't going to certainly run a mile.
No, we're
down
just gonna,
a slope.
They'll slice the tent, but stay in the tent.
Yeah, or go back, you know, go 50 feet away and then come back.
But a good question. Avalanche was something I thought about. Josh is in Ocala, Florida. Welcome to the program. Hey, Josh, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My friend and I have been listening to your show, and we're paranormal investigators here in Florida.
Okay.
And we were tossing ideas back and forth, and my coworker come up with a theory, and I just wanted to run it by you guys.
Sure.
The U.S. government has experimented with microwave technology to disperse crowds and stuff like crowd control.
Right.
What if the Russian government were testing something like this at that time, and it would explain why they had to leave the tent, because it was getting so hot, you know, they had to strip off their clothes, cut their way out of the tent, and run as far as they could because it was just getting blistering hot inside.
What do you think of that one, Donnie?
I think it's a good theory. I actually did investigate that.
It was 59 technology. They didn't have much then.
Yeah, they didn't have much, and it was really hard to control back then. That was the problem, is that even if they did use something like that, it would spread. It wasn't a controllable weapon.
Good thought, though. So many theories. So how important is the missing tongue in this whole case? That seems to be the strange part of everything.
You know, it was something that I found really compelling when I started, but through the investigation, there's a very logical reason as to what happened to Luda's tongue.
Did she swallow it?
She didn't swallow it, no. It has to do with, she actually was one of the hikers that fell into a ravine. So
she may have chopped it off when she fell, bit into it. I mean, I guess explain this to me, though.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to be coy even about this tongue story. Mm-hmm. Is it part of your theory?
It isn't.
It is not.
It is not.
Okay, so what do you think happened to her tongue?
Well, she fell into a ravine, and when spring comes, the snow starts to melt where there's a creek there.
Okay.
So if you're upside down in the ravine and the snow starts to melt and there's water starts to run over the body, there's microfauna that occurs. And, you know, along with that, with the water, it can decompose the fleshiest parts of the body. So she was actually upside down.
And the tongue just kind of dissolved away?
The tongue is one of the fleshiest parts of the body. And when she was found, they pulled her out of, you know, actual water.
She'd been under for a while.
Yeah.
What a grisly sight that must have been.
It was. And that was another thing I had discovered on my first trip is, you know, over 300 photos, and a lot of them were autopsy photos. And, you know, a lot of them I got developed when I was actually in Russia. And it was quite shocking.
What about the fractures and the broken ribs on some of the other people?
That's explainable as well.
They fell? Something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You're working me, George.
I am. All right, we go next to Will in Philadelphia. Hey, Will, thanks for calling.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good, Will.
And Donnie, I think the man with the avalanche might be part of it. I was thinking they had a fear of a rock slide or an avalanche. What else would make you run out so quick?
With no clothes on.
Yeah. Well, maybe something with the wind made that noise. I don't know.
Maybe they thought.
Obviously, it had something to do with the wind. You know, we're getting hints from Donnie.
I think so, too. Maybe they thought there was an avalanche and they escaped.
Yeah.
Is
they
that
heard
possible?
The wind made it sound like it, and they figured, we don't have much time. What are you going to do? You got to get out quick.
We're gone.
But then they couldn't find their way back because it was dark.
And they kept going. Donnie, what do you think of that?
The fear of the unknown in complete darkness would be the most horrifying thing to me if I were the hikers.
It's like running with your eyes closed.
Exactly. Exactly.
Huh. Now, something scared them to death. Literally.
Literally, yes.
Scared them to death. Let me ask you this. Knowing what you know and this theory that you are speculating with, would you run out of the tent? If whatever happened to them happened and you were there?
I absolutely would.
You would?
I would.
Would you keep running? Even with no clothes?
I would.
Wow.
I would. And I've, you know, that's a great question, George, and I've thought about that a lot. I've tried to put myself in their place and standing there, looking down into that ravine and then working with scientists and coming up with this conclusion. I would have done the same thing.
So you cannot blame them for whatever fear they had. And what's so amazing is they were all scared. There wasn't one person there who said, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. They all took off.
That's a great point.
Wow.
Yeah.
Will, thanks for yours. Good theory. Everybody's got a good theory. I'm going to beat you up there, Donnie, and we'll get this answer out of you. Well, let's go to Olathe in Colorado. Jay's with us, first-time caller. Go ahead, Jay.
Hi, thanks for letting me talk.
Sure thing.
Were there any autopsies? Because I'm thinking if there was some weird atmospheric change that broke their eardrums all of a sudden, that'd drive me crazy.
There were autopsies, yes, but there were no broken eardrums.
Nothing unusual other than the fractured ribs and the skull? And was there any similarities to all their bodies?
No. There wasn't, but, you know, what was unusual were the brutal injuries and the skull fracture. That was another thing that grabbed me about this case.
That's baffling.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying the anomaly created the fractures, whatever this anomaly might be?
I'm saying the circumstances from the event created the violent injuries.
What if they were abducted by a UFO and dumped a mile away?
You know, one theory Yuri Yudin had, which I didn't believe, but that men had come in a helicopter and because they were somewhere they shouldn't have been and dropped them to their death in order to set it up. They knew they would die.
Pushed them out of the yeah. helicopter one at a time.
But again, in the middle of the Cold War, I would think the Soviet officials would have better things to do at the time.
You would think so, but that would explain fractures, wouldn't it?
It would explain fractures, absolutely. But I do explain how these violent injuries occurred in the book.
Donnie, good luck with this work. Keep in touch with me. You're in L.A. I'm in L.A. You know, any documentaries you work on, just let us know, okay?
Absolutely, George. It's been a pleasure.
All right, you take care of yourself. What an incredible story. Truly incredible. I got to find out what happened. For Dan Galante, Jason King, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.